podcast. We've had a little bit of a hiatus, but Lauren and I are excited to bring it back. So I'm Jody Rachens. I'm the Director of Disability Services here at UMass Lowell.
And I'm Lauren Tornatore. I'm the Senior Assistant Director for Disability Education and Enhancement here at UMass Lowell.
And we are very excited to have three special guests that we tried to have last year, and we had a random day of no power out of absolutely nowhere and not weather related. And so we're back at it again today, which is exciting. So what I'm first going to do is I'm going to actually play a couple of promotional videos of each one of them, and then we'll have some time to chat with them. Okay, now we check my tech skills. So I go share. And I do this. And okay, first one.
What really is normal? I hate that it happens, but I'm going to break bones in my life. And I'm not gonna know when that happened. And that is my normal. If I have like a broken leg and I'm gonna work on my arm. If I have a broken shoulder, okay, I'm gonna get in and I'm gonna kick. This is really who I am. Hello, Who I Am fans, Mackenzie Cohen here. I hope you're all staying safe and healthy and getting excited for the Tokyo 2020 Games next year. I know I am, and I know that looking forward to Tokyo 2020 is what is getting me through these hard times. So I am currently at home in Georgia, where I am continuing to train as much as I can. And then I also get in the water whenever possible. And I'm also working on sports psychology training and visualizing the games for next year. I think it would be amazing and such an honor to be on the podium again for the USA. It is such an indescribable feeling to go out there and compete and win a medal for your country. But more so, I think the Tokyo 2020 Games are going to mean more than ever, especially with what the world is going through right now. Being able to come together next year and unite as one and show that we can come back from this. And I truly cannot wait. For the best games.
Gosh. I like you are sharing screen is right in my way. Okay. Next one. Nope. What's going on? I don't know why it thinks it's editing.
A blind woman with a white cane enters JFK Airport.
I'm catching a flight to Lima.
You want to have somebody come escort you?
No, I want to try to do it on my own. I think I have a little bit of time.
This is Mona Minkara, the blind traveler.
In my day job.
Oh, thank you. Hold on. Oh my gosh. Everything's going wild. Okay. Okay, I'm so sorry. I knew I was going to do something ridiculous with technology, but let's try again. Okay. And I got to go back to sharing. Okay, because I was sharing, but I'm back to not sharing. Okay, here we go. And off we go for real. Okay.
A blind woman with a white cane enters JFK Airport.
I'm catching a flight to Lima.
To have somebody come escort you?
No, I want to try to do it on my own. I think I have a little bit of time.
This is Mona Minkara, the blind traveler.
In my day job, I'm a professor of bioengineering, so I'm a scientist.
Flipping in zero gravity.
And I've been blind since I was a kid.
Walking.
And I think a lot of times people think blind people should be
plane.
Protected, safe at home. And it's really important for blind people to have freedom. Freedom of doing what they want to do just like anybody else. So
totally agree.
It's almost like you're emancipating yourself.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
It makes sense in a way, but it's impossible.
Is it though?
alone on a train scanning for cues.
I don't know what my next step is going to be, so I just walk and listen for cues.
Listening.
So it's kind of exciting and exhilarating.
Mona walks into a restricted area.
Hola. Hola.
Yes. Oh, that, which way?
Okay. Sweden.
We got off again this time.
Alleyway.
It's dark. It's nighttime. It's past 1 a.m. I don't even know.
Mona pulls on double doors.
I went to a government building, I tried the door, I triggered an alarm. Four guys with big guns came, apparently. Is this the Hyatt Hotel?
No, it's called the Tessinska palatset.
A.K.A. Tessin Palace, property of the Swedish crown.
This is too much. But I will not give up at this point. And I got a blister. So what is the cost of independence?
Mona shows her hand.
A blister. I'll take it any day.
Remote town of Paran.
So it seems like everybody knows around here that blind people live here.
Blind man points to his eyes.
I came here to talk to them because they are my people, right? They're like me.
Meeting new people.
And if you operate that there's value in everyone having access,
dancing.
Then the society you build
crosswalk.
Is one that's gonna progress.
Walking with tour guide.
Again, like I said, it doesn't mean that I don't want the help sometimes. No, I think the systems to help people is
real.
On point. But it's just the fact that society just operates on the default.
In airport bus.
That I can't do it. No, let me try.
Mona looks ahead.
So let's see.
Mona ziplines. It's down a mountain. Cusco. Peruvian dance. Norway. Machu Picchu. Aguas Calientes. Train. Fjords. Peruvian outskirts. Cliffside road. Norwegian waterfalls. Petting a horse. Train.
My dream is coming true!
Planes, Trains, and Kane Season 2. Coming soon, February 2023.
Okay.
Made possible by the Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired.
Okay. Am I doing good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the last person we have here with us today. Oh my God, it just does the annotate thing again. Every time I go to press play, everything's in the way. Do that X. Okay.
It's a lonely, lonely world.
This is my diagnosis, the actual time I got diagnosed on the autism spectrum. And I skipped home because I felt freer than I ever had. It explained everything that had ever happened to me that didn't make sense.
It's a lonely, lonely world.
Noah has a little trio of...
Like, yes. This stuff is about, you know, do you like us for who we are, or do right. you like us for what it says about you? And if it's the latter, then we'll take your money, but we don't really care about you. But if you like autistic comedy, like, as I said, Airplane, Stephen Wright stuff, that was why we formed, because we were like, there's not enough of this. We right. love that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, yes. This stuff is about, you know, do you like us for who we are?
Okay, last video to show Noah.
Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. Let's take just a moment for those who are on the phone to know who's here. I'll start to my left.
I'm Alan Guttmacher, the director of the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development here at NIH.
I'm Linda Birnbaum. I'm the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences here at NIH.
Hi, Lynn Redwood, Coalition to Save Minds.
Hi, I'm Noah Britton. I'm a very handsome man.
So thank you. Okay, I am going to stop the screen sharing and we're going to get on here. Okay. Can everybody hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, good. All right. So we're going to start with our first questions, which is the first question that we pretty much ask anybody who's ever a guest on our podcast. So we're going to ask our panelists to introduce themselves, their connection to the word disability, and how has your personal definition of disability changed over time? And if so, how so? So we'll start with Mackenzie.
Awesome. We got to turn hers on, right?
I did.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, we're good. All right. Awesome. First off, I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm super excited we could do this. My name is Mackenzie Cohen. I am a four-time Paralympian in the sport of swimming. I'm also a four-time gold medalist. thank you. A lot of work, a lot of fun. I love it. I'm also an author and a professional speaker. And I have a condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a big, long mixture of complicated words that basically means I have brittle bones that often break for little to no reason. And I was diagnosed at 19 days old after I was born with a broken femur. And then my mom accidentally broke my arm burping me right before I was diagnosed. So definitely something was off, and then the genetic testing confirmed it. I have endured over 100 broken bones in my lifetime, but that number could go over 200 at this point. I often break things that I don't even know about, to be honest with you. Fun fact, I actually have a broken shoulder right now that I just found out about last week, so news to me. Over time, I definitely would say my definition of disability has changed. I think when I was younger, and I'm sure you hear this a lot from people with disabilities and discovering and accepting that identity, perhaps sometimes I found my disability to be limiting in a sense. And I think through a lot of personal experience, certainly some confidence that I gained from the water, I've come to find that my disability is not limiting in any way. I would say it's actually the thing that has given me life. I see a big sense of community within it. I see a lot of personal strength that I built up. And I can say without a shadow of a doubt, I would not be who I am without my disability, but my disability certainly does not define me.
Thank you, Mackenzie. Okay, Mona, I'm going to have you share a little bit about yourself and your connection to the word disability and how your definition of the word disability has changed over time.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mona. So actually, you all saw a video of me traveling, but in my day job, I am a scientist. I'm a professor of bioengineering at Northeastern University, and I run my own lab. But like, my connection to the word disability is I'm blind. And what's really interesting about my journey with that word is when I was a kid, when I was first diagnosed, everybody had a very catastrophic, like, oh my God, like end of my life feeling reaction to it. And so as a kid, I thought it was a negative thing. But now as I grow older and as I embrace and realize, like, as a scientist, I'm one of the few blind scientists in the world. And the way I do my science is so different. And that's actually allowed me to discover things that other people missed. And because, to me right now, like, I'm proud of having my disability. I am blind. I think this gives me new perspectives. And I would, just like Mackenzie said, I wouldn't be the person who I am today without my journey of being a blind.
Thank you so much. And Noah, you are up.
Sure. I'm Noah Britton. I'm a psych professor. I've been in a sketch comedy troupe for 15 years, and I make music, which you heard in the trailer. I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome in 2002. And ever since then, I think being autistic has been a huge part of my identity. It's helped me find like-minded people. And at that time, I immediately went to this autistic pride movement, which was burgeoning, but has become much more popular since. And I think really went to, this is great, and there's no problem associated with it. And over the years, my understanding of disability has changed in the opposite direction that I think the other two panelists have, where at that time I didn't see autism as being a problem at all, really. And now I, through my own experience working with autistic people, I've worked with autistic people for 20 years, seeing the downsides and being aware of the fact that obviously this doesn't make me worthless or incapable, but it does cause me real problems, and denying that is foolish and unfair to myself and anyone else.
Thank you, Noah. I do feel like I need to give two little shout outs. So Noah's show, Asperger's R Us, is actually on HBO Max. So it's like kind of a big deal. And it was the Duplass brothers that produced it, right, Noah? Yes. And one of the members of the troupe is a UMass Lowell alum. I believe New Michael, but I'm not totally sure.
He's not an alum. He dropped out because UMass Lowell put him on a track he couldn't pass. So he has not graduated. He has returned multiple times and been unable to complete his education.
Oh no, the last time I talked to him, he was so at school.
Yep, that took a long time. Well, he would love help. If any of you have a way he can solve this problem and pass his courses, that would be awesome. He's very close, but miles away at the same time.
We can't do it for him, but we would love to help him give it a try. I know.
Yeah, that would be great. Definitely.
We wanted to move into a little bit of individual questions for each of our panelists, just based off of all of your backgrounds. So I'm going to start with Mackenzie. Right now we do still have a lack of role models in popular culture, especially when we're looking at the relation of sports and disability. Mental health seems to be gaining traction, I would say in the last 5 years or so, but that's not really a full picture of disability. Who are some of your role models, Ben? And how can we promote a more well-rounded vision of a person, an athlete with a disability?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I feel like I've been really kind of spoiled growing up in the Paralympic world. Obviously I had my athletic idols around me on pool decks all the time. I had Erin Popovich. I think she has 19 Paralympic medals. I had Jessica Long, who has probably 30 Paralympic medals by now. I mean, I was just surrounded by all these really incredible Paralympians. And as I started to get older, certainly I still had these idols on the pool deck, but I also looked around me and thought to myself, I have dreams that go so much further than just how fast I can get up and down a swimming pool. And so I looked at these incredible Paralympians that I was around who are also doing huge things outside of the water. Dr. Sherry Blotwit, she's here in Boston. She works at, I believe, Mass Gen. She's like the head of sports medicine there. And she's been to several Paralympic games. We had another Paralympic swimmer, Deb Gruen, who went to Georgetown Law School and now practices big law in New York. So I had all these incredible role models around me that were kind of showing me what was possible beyond just a career in the water. And so I feel really blessed and fortunate about that. Now, on the flip side of that, I think when it comes to kind of maybe the media and how they portray athletes with a disability, I think a lot of times Paralympians or Paralympic athletes are at a disadvantage, because I feel very strongly that some of the stuff that is put out about us is meant to be, I hate to put it this way, but there's no other way to put it. I know you guys have heard it. Inspiration porn.
Yes.
And that is just not the way that I would like us Paralympic athletes to be portrayed. I think our Olympic counterparts, and I've thought this for a long time, get their fair share of stories that encompass them entirely as a person in and outside of their sport. And Paralympic athletes a lot of times don't get that. And it can be very, very frustrating. I certainly think since the Rio Games, we've seen positive changes. The more viewership that we've gotten, I think we had 5,000 hours of viewership in Rio, 8,000 in Tokyo, and 12,000 in Paris. So obviously many more opportunities to put those stories out there. But still, a lot of times, it's just the inspirational horn of it all. So I would obviously like to see more stories kind of encompassing the entire person. Like, let me tell you about yes, the struggles that I've had as an athlete with a disability, but let me also tell you about the mundane everyday life that I live, how these things that happen to me that you see as, oh my God, I can't believe she deals with that adversity on a daily basis, that's my normal life. It's not supposed to be inspiring to you to tell you to get out of bed every day, put your shoes on, and go get what you need to get done, just because I can do it in a different way. So with that said, I am very fortunate with how far we have come, but it would be naive of me to say that we do not have a lot further to go within that as well.
There, thank you. I'm going to move to Noah now. We have we could just talk to each individual person this entire time, but I'll move on to Noah next with a question for you, Noah, about the arts. So much of the arts really involves like nuanced thinking and personal interpretation. And a common misconception is that people with autism are concrete thinkers and may not enjoy participating in things like acting. What would you say about that misconception of the concrete thinking? And how did you discover that comedy, music, and acting were an outlet for you?
Well, I think what the comedy troupe always said, I think is true of a lot of autistic people. I'm going to make generalizations today, but of course there'll be exceptions. But I think this is true of a lot of us, which is, you know, the biggest thing with autism is we don't want to be perceived. We want to just exist as a perspective. And so in the process of performing, if you're thinking about there are human beings watching me, that would be terrifying and make you not want to do it. So what we do is focus on, here's a good idea I have that if I watched this, I would like it, and I'm going to do it the best I can. And the audience are an abstract mass of encouragement or occasionally not encouragement. But if we saw them as individual people, it would be too overwhelming to do. And as a result, as an actor, I'm extremely bad at reacting. So if I'm working with someone else in a scene and they're doing something, I'm pretty blank, which is a terrible trait if that's what you're supposed to do as an actor. But I'm able to perform sort of following the objective rules pretty easily, as long as I recognize the audience is an abstract mass and not individuals perceiving someone they would call Noah Britton. So I think the stereotype you're describing is pretty true. There's just ways of approaching this that make it viable in a lot of ways.
Thank you. Can you speak a little bit more, Noah, about how you discovered like getting into the arts for you?
Sure. I mean, I think I was born to perform. When I was 5, I was in a play at school and I improvised, just like putting a trash can on my head to get a laugh, because I was always very like, I need that reaction. That's the thing that motivates me. And so growing up, I was like, how do I perform? How do I make this happen? And luckily I was able to get in a troupe that, as you mentioned, we have an HBO series now. Our movie, which you showed the trailer for, was on Netflix for 7 years. It's not on there anymore. You can buy it on Amazon or other places where you can buy stuff, but the series that's a follow-up is still on HBO. And I'm really grateful those guys toured the world with me, and we got to be so funny because we have an overlapping sense of humor because of autism. And that's something that we always tried to appeal to. And I think something that your other panelist was talking about is inspo porn is really obnoxious when your goal is to be funny. And our movie was absolutely inspiration porn, and we were really upset about it and fought with the director a lot about, you know, this is a good movie from that perspective, but it doesn't do us justice as a comedy troupe. And you know, that was one of the reasons I think that we haven't been active in several years, is because we really got tired of being pigeonholed as just an inspirational story, as opposed to comedians who are trying to appeal to other autistic people with the same sense of humor.
Thank you. I'll go over to Mona now. What made you want to challenge the misconception that a blind person can't see or experience the beauty of the world? As you traveled the world, what locations were more easily accessible versus ones that were more challenging, and why?
Okay, so first of all, I have to say that when I went to create Planes, Trains, and Canes, it wasn't necessarily my intention to challenge a misconception. It was just like, how do I get to experience the world and have somebody else pay for it? So that was my intention. It didn't even cross my mind that there were people out there that would legitimately question my purpose and why I would even travel as a blind person. So that was something that like came to light later on as I started putting out episodes on the YouTube channel, and having people reacting to that and saying like, why are you traveling? You can't see. And so like, that didn't even like cross my mind until then. So that was really interesting. And then I think you asked what was hard in terms of access.
More like easily accessible work, yes, versus that were more challenging.
I'm going to answer that question a little bit like not tangentially, but a little bit of an offshoot. So yeah, there are physical barriers, and you know, and that's a legitimate concern, you know, like literally if there is no public transport, if it's not accessible, that makes it a lot harder. But what I personally found even harder than just physical barriers was social perceptions of my ability. So there were cultures in which they left me alone until I asked for help, and I got the help when I asked for it. And then there were places I went to in which people constantly were like, where's your caretaker? Like, if I ask for help, they don't actually tell me where to go. They'll just be like, where's your caretaker? How could you be alone? How could you be on your own as a blind? And that to me was extremely challenging. That was very emotionally draining, actually. So to me, that was the hardest access, but the easiest for me was because if people are just willing to talk to you and be like, yeah, it's on the left down the street, like if people listen to you, like as a blind person, a lot of times they see me, they have a preconceived notion of my abilities, and they just won't hear what I'm trying to say. Like, it could be something as simple as, is this the grocery store? And they just won't answer and be like, where's your caretaker? So that to me is the most challenging. But on the flip side, when people actually do help and listen, everything has a solution.
So when I first contacted Mona, I told her.
Oh no, Jody, I can't hear you. I can't tell if it's on my end.
It's everybody has lost the audio, Jody.
Okay.
Thank you, Mona.
Yeah, thank you, Noah. Nice to meet you. I really like your story.
It's nice to meet you.
And Melissa too. I don't know if she's still. Yeah, where are you at? Where are you, professor?
Also in Boston, yeah.
Oh, what school?
MCPHS right now.
I'm at North Asia. Yeah.
Nice.
Hello?
Very close. We can hear you again, Jody.
Yeah.
This is so strange.
We can hear you. You're working.
Are you? Can you hear us now?
Yes.
Yeah. I lost your last statement. Like, I don't. You were saying something.
So
sorry,
I was giving you a compliment, but let me try the other microphone. Hold on. Okay. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now, Mona?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. We changed absolutely nothing about the audio, so I have nothing to say about that. But we enjoyed your chat between you and Noah of where you both work. So, anyway, I was saying that when I first contacted you, I'm a little bit of a fangirl of your series on YouTube. And when you were just talking right now, what I was remembering, and you're going to tell me what country it was if you remember, but like
It was in London.
London. Yep. So you know what I'm talking about.
And the London Underground when like.
The tube. Yeah. And they were that man that just wouldn't let you walk to the other, wouldn't tell you right or left and wouldn't let you walk there alone.
Oh, they wouldn't even let me ride the train on my own. Like what was crazy about that scene, just for everybody else's background. So I land in London, I make my way to the underground, you know, like walking from the, you know, the airport to the underground, which is like in the airport. I get there and I'm just like, I just need to know where the train is. And then so this guy comes and then he brings like 3-4 other men with him. And they all kind of surround me. And I'm just for a visual, I'm a pretty short lady, you know, like I'm like 5'3", like, and then these tall big men surround me and they're like, you can't go on your own. And I'm like off a red eye, I'm exhausted. And I'm like, I get into an argument. I'm like, why can't I ride the train on my own? Like, and he was like, you're a VIP. I'm like, what do you mean? Like a very important person? I'm not. He's like, no, 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 you're a visually impaired person. We don't let VIPs ride the train on their own. I was like, what? Like, it was just so mind boggling to me. And an argument ensued. Like, and I was like, you can't let me ride just because you know I'm blind. Like, so you should watch to see what happens.
Ooh, you leave a cliffhanger. I do have to say, though, in these cringy moments throughout the series, I am so impressed with your poise, and you never stop being polite or kind, and that is hard to maintain.
Thank you. I don't know. I could have done a better job at that moment. I at one point I'm like, I'm a highly intelligent woman. Like, what? That's irrelevant. I don't even need to be intelligent. Like, I'm kind of, you know, but whatever. I could have done a better job. It's fine.
I think I would have done a quite worse job, so we'll just leave it there. But yeah, if you want to see the cliffhanger of whether Mona gets to travel in London, you must watch the show. Okay, so I'm going to throw this out to whoever kind of wants a ticket first, and not all three people have to answer these questions, but so this question is all about how we need community in some sense to thrive in our daily lives. Do you feel that you're part of a disability community? What makes up this community for you? And then because this is a college, a university, and we have students here that'll be listening to this and are listening to this, maybe you can talk a little bit about your own college experience and how you found community there or what you would have liked it to look like. So popcorn style here.
I had a very autistic college experience. I lived in the dorms for a year and made zero friends my first year on campus. I ended up trying to make a game of could I go the whole year without talking to anybody. There's no reason. This isn't beneficial. This was just an impulse I had. I'm sure this is relatable to a lot of autistic people making choices like this. And my second year, I was in the dorm again, and 2 months in, I still hadn't talked to anybody, but I was coming home from a show I had just played, and my neighbor in my dorm saw my guitar and we started talking about it. And from that, I met other people in the dorm and they introduced me to other people. And then I made really good friends who are still my closest friends 20 years later. None of the people I went to college with were autistic. And I was really craving other autistic friends just to have people who understood the world the same way I do. And luckily in college, I got a diagnosis. And that diagnosis helped me develop friends on the internet and also my first job out of college working at the camp where I met the other guys in Asperger's or Us. And they're still some of my closest friends. So this was an example where college itself didn't give me the community, at least the community for my disability, but it did give me the diagnosis that got me to that community. And I'm very grateful now. I have many friends who are autistic and not, and I think that was very helpful.
That's a follow-up for you. Well, I was just wondering when you talked about, you know, after your first year in college and kind of not really making connections, what made you go back for your second year? Because I feel like a lot of people would just give up at that point and not go back to school.
Well, I wasn't in college to make friends. I was there to get a degree. you know, if I were at Friendship Club, absolutely, I would have quit after a year of making no friends. But it was a job. So yeah. I went. And luckily, incidentally, I made friends after a while. But yeah, I also spent my first year on living on campus. I had some friends, just no one at college. You know, people I knew from the internet or people I knew from high school or people who lived, you know, in Massachusetts, but didn't go to my college. So it wasn't like I was completely alone all the time.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone else want to take this one? Mackenzie does. Yeah. Okay.
Is this one still?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I have that one. Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So, kind of speaking of this, obviously, with the whole Paralympic swimming thing going on, I had a good disability community around me growing up, but I think it started even before that. My parents were really involved in the OI Foundation community, so the Brittle Bone Society. I was going to conferences and things from when I was little, and then they also, this was kind of what made the difference for us. They had an OI parent support group kind of across the country, kind of like phone lines and different people that you could call if, you know, maybe I fell and broke something. Well, my mom doesn't know how to deal with this fracture, so let me call X, Y, and Z and get their advice and opinion. So that kind of opened it up to a whole network of people who also knew others in our area who they could point us in the direction of. So that kind of laid the foundation for it and how to meet people and form those connections. When I got to college, I went to Loyola University in Maryland, and I think it was quite an interesting experience coming in as a freshman with a disability. I was lucky in that the swimming program there had another incoming freshman who had a disability who I knew from the national team with swimming. But outside of that, it was the two of us. And then the rest of the campus with obviously the majority able-bodied student body. And I kind of wrestled with this a little bit my freshman year. Obviously, I have a disability, you can tell, but it's like I'm coming in as a freshman. I want to be a normal, quote unquote, freshman student incoming. But even during orientation week, there were some things I had to make adjustments to for accessibility. We went to a baseball game. I couldn't get on the bus. I had to have a special, you know, just things like that where it was almost like when I went into high school, I was going through that process all over again of here I am. Here's my disability. I'm proud of it, but also I get around differently and I've got to learn for the very first time on my own without my family here to make a community of my own. So I kind of had to go back and rely on how I built that foundation for myself in the first place. How am I going to do that here? And then also, how am I going to balance, you know, swimming with a majority able-bodied varsity team as well? How am I going to be looked at college meets on the deck? I certainly didn't want kind of a sense of tokenism put on me. That's not what it was about. And I got really lucky with the coach there, Brian Loeffler, who obviously wasn't going to let that happen. I trained side by side with the varsity team. I competed in the same events at competitions, but that didn't mean that it wasn't difficult to be finishing the majority of the time behind everyone else. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that? How do you be one of the first kind of people to come out and, you know, on a varsity team and have a disability and swim and show them what Paralympic swimming is? So I think that's how I kind of looked at it in my mind. How do I show others what is possible?
Thank you. Do you wish to take this or do you wish to wait for future questions?
She's
muted.
Oh, I'm saying whatever you want. I mean, I could give a quick answer. I do think community is important. I had a really unique situation where my sister, I'm the oldest, but my sister is 2 years younger than me and she's also blind. But then nobody else in the entire public school system was blind where I grew up. Nobody else at my undergrad was blind until actually my sister ended up going to the same school afterwards, but I was the first, and I don't know if anybody else yet since, who graduated from Wellesley who was blind with a science degree in all the years Wellesley was open at the time. So Wellesley has been open since 1875. So I've always been looking for community, but now I'm like, I found other blind scientists in the world. And that's the community that I connect with personally. I think the fact that, you know, being blind and doing science is very important to me. But also, if you watch Planes, Trains, and Canes, and you see, like, I seek out blind people from around the world. I feel like no matter who you are, if you're blind, I feel like you're part of my tribe. And that's just a connection. A community is important. It's just a part of my, it's one aspect to my identity, and it's an important one. And I connect to anybody else who also identifies that way.
Into a little bit of a topic that everyone's kind of touched upon a little bit in terms of like stereotyping, stigma, or tokenism. You know, we know that sometimes people with disabilities can be presumed to not have the level of independence that you actually have, or that you may be presumed to have multiple disabilities. So, for example, a person with a speech impairment may be presumed to have an intellectual disability in addition. And so I'm wondering if anyone would be able to speak on how you feel stigma has maybe changed over our lifetimes and where you feel it still needs to go. I know this is a topic we talk about a lot in our office about reminding everyone in our world that the students that are registered with our office are fully capable adults. They are here to get a degree, and we believe that they can do the same things everyone else on campus can do. And although higher education disability has come a long way, we know that there still is our feelings out there sometimes that will assume that the disability needs to have their parent involved in every aspect, even though we don't expect that on any other student at the university. So that's just an example. But I'm wondering if anyone would feel comfortable kind of speaking to that stigma, that tokenism that we talked about, and kind of where it still needs to go from here.
I would love to jump in. Okay, so tokenism. I feel like I get tokenized so much as a blind person, and in really random ways sometimes. Like, literally, people might speak louder to me because they see that I'm blind. That's a legit thing that happens to me still. I'm 38 years old. I've traveled the world, and people will like assume. They'll ask, can you put on your seatbelt on the plane? I'd be like, yes, I can. And they'd be like, no, really? Can you? And I'm like, you're asking me again? Like, so there's a lot. And it's so fascinating. Sometimes I feel like when I'm traveling and I'm just another person in the crowd, I mean, I'm a blind person, so it sticks out. I have a cane and I feel like everybody knows that I'm blind, but even though they don't know me, right? Like when I'm in an airplane or flying or going somewhere new, people don't know me. And it is so mind-boggling to them if we ever get to the point in which I share what I do. The assumption is always like, I'm sorry you're blind. Like basically my life, and there are challenges in my life for being blind. That's true. But like, I'm living a pretty great life. Like I have a lot of privileges that I'm really grateful for. But there's a lot of preconceived notions that blow my mind. And sometimes I can't even get to the point in which I'm like, yeah, and by the way, like, I'm a professor. They're like, wow, you're a professor? I'm like, yeah. I have a PhD in chemistry. What? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it just blows people's minds that I don't even bother bringing it up, what I do. it gets even more interesting. Like I'll be like, yes, I have a PhD in chemistry, and then they'll be like, what? I'll be like, yeah, I run my own lab. They're like, what? Like literally, people cannot connect the dots, and so I just don't even bother. I'm just like, yeah, I'm blind. They're like, who takes care of you? I'm like, I live alone. Like I don't. Yeah. So that's like legit. I get tokenized so much. I feel like it's like humbling to my ego, even if I didn't ask for it.
Moni, you're getting a lot of laughs in the room. I just want you to know that.
Thank you. Like, so there you go. That's tokenism, you know.
I'll quickly just jump in and say, yeah, Mona. I mean, I feel it too. Just Asperger's or us always got tokenized, and we had so many shows where what we were doing was going over the audience's head because they assumed the best we could do would be like what an 8-year-old would come up with. And so we were doing really rich, complex things. And they'd be like, I don't really understand this, but it's because they're too stupid to realize that what they're doing isn't joke.
It's so disappointing. Sorry, Noah.
No, I know. I mean, it sucks. And that's unfortunately, it's the double-edged sword, because that's why we got a TV show, was the fact that there were people who were interested in us for that reason. We didn't think that would be how it worked. We were expecting, you guys are funny because of your autism in a very specific way, and that's why we're going to make this TV show. And we were really sad when we realized this is not the filmmaker's intentions, and this is not a palatable package to sell to the world. And so I don't blame the filmmaker for making inspo porn with us, but yeah, I feel you on that one. I do think the stigma has decreased with time. I think nowadays people know more about autism, so they're at least not immediately dismissing us as being completely incompetent. Not everyone, of course. Plenty of people are still doing that, but not as much as they used to. And yeah, that, like, oh my God, you did this. And you're like, yeah, of course I did this. Like, what the hell's wrong with you? Why would you see me as incapable? It never crossed our minds to consider ourselves incapable. And we were shocked by the audience's response. After we'd done a really clever airplane level show, they'd say stuff like, I can't believe your favorite actor isn't young Sheldon. And we'd be like, that's everything that offends us. How dare you? You just watched our show and that's what you're thinking. And that stuff still hurts.
I also have to add, Mona. Okay, so you just hit the nail on the head, because why is it always airports? I've got a rant for a second. It's always airports where I feel like it happens the most to me, where I'll go up to the gate. You know, I've traveled the world with swimming, and maybe I'm checking at the airport. I'll go up and everything. And my partner, sometimes he'll drive me to the airport when I'm going to leave. And their response is always, okay, so you're both traveling? No, I'm going alone. You're going alone? Oh, wow. Like, on the airplane by yourself? Yes, I am going alone. And it's always so funny to me. And then I have the strangest interactions with people in airports. I don't know why, but people always just want to come by and they'll tell me, it gets better. And I'll look around for a second. I'm like, what gets better than this? I'm actually on my way to Tokyo to go to an international swim meet right now. Yeah, I'm a professional athlete. You're a professional athlete? Yes, I see this is going to be a long conversation, but yes, I am. So I just have to point that out. That was great that you mentioned that. It's always airports. I don't know why.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know either, but that's so true. I don't know.
Just extra panicky. Noah, I just have to say thank you for pointing out young Sheldon. You have no idea, you know, especially when I first got into the field, people would be like, oh, you just work with somebody who is like that. And I'm like, no, not at all. Please don't use that as an example of people with autism. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, back when we were really active, it was Big Bang Theory, but I got to give that show credit. It became more autistic affirming in its humor. At first it was very much just making fun of autism, and then gradually they put jokes that an autistic person would write in, but I still never really watched it. I saw it once and that was enough.
Like, there's something in the media that does an okay job representing?
I mean, I think that's a very good question. There are autistic comedians out there who do jokes, you know, not about being autistic, but because we're autistic, who aren't just Asperger's or us, you know. Just the, I think the thing that's unique about us is we're the only group of autistic people doing comedy. And at least last I checked, we were the only group of autistic people doing anything collaboratively with just autistic people. That was years ago that I looked. I'm sure it's happened since. But so that, I think, is why we were such an anomaly. But yeah, there are autistic comedians who I love who are like, very funny. And I'm like, yeah, you're funny. You're good at this. You're someone who I like what you're doing because it's autistic and it really makes sense to me. But it isn't for the neurotypicals to understand. It's a very specific autistic style of humor. Again, very much like Airplane. Not referencing airports for the same reason Mona and Mackenzie were. But yeah.
That's the movie. Mona, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just gonna add, I realized I didn't answer the stigma part of it, but you know, blindness has had a really interesting just history, right? So like cultures and societies really react very strongly to when they see a blind person. Sometimes it's from a place of like, you know, blindness is ignorance, and we even use that in our language, right? Like, are you blind? Are you like blind? Like, this blindsided you. This, you know, like even without realizing, the word itself is so weighted in a lot of negatives, unfortunately. Like in the past, to be told that you're blind meant that you're also ignorant. That there's all these like negative connotations, and there's history that goes all the way back to the Greeks, you know? And then on the other hand, you also get people who just like venerate you. Oh my God, you're blind. Like, there must be something like mystical about you. So it's really fascinating. I think that when society sees like a blind person in front of them, it brings up a lot of internal feelings to the person in front of, like, to them. Like, there's a lot of fear of people becoming blind, you know. I think studies have shown that, like, as human beings, humans on average rely like 80% of their, out of all five senses, they rely 80% on eyesight. So it just tells you how much like we value eyesight, and thereby people react when they see that I don't have eyesight. It's really interesting. So I just want to share that.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about how, like, just in colloquial language, there's just so many words that are just stuck right in our language all the time that we don't even realize are connected to people who are trying to be people and live their lives.
Okay. I want to ask Mona, Mona, do you do this? Because I had a blind friend, and every time I would be with him, he would say, "It's great to see you." And I was really curious, is this like colloquially something that fell into your language or not?
Yeah, I don't rely as much on it. It is very colloquially so common, but like if I ever use it, I don't mean it in the literal sense of using my eyes, but like, you know, because I'm not seeing you. But you know, some other people be like, "Oh no, I didn't mean to say see you," and I'm like, "It's fine, you can see me, but I cannot see you."
Yeah. like, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I was just curious.
Yeah.
That a little bit too. I don't know, Mackenzie, if you get something the people say, "Oh, let's take a walk." "Oh, wait, let's not take a walk." Do you get that too?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I get that. Yep. And then someone said something one time. It was like, "Let's run over here real quick" or something. And then they looked at me and I was, I'm like, "Oh, it's fine." But yeah, it's like the little things in the everyday. It's like, "Oh," and then people think twice about it sometimes, like, "Okay."
Can I ask a question to you, Mackenzie, actually?
Yeah.
So I can't see either you or Noah, but is like, are you in a wheelchair, Mackenzie? Sorry, like, are there any visual like indicators to the fact having brittle bone? Yeah.
We overlooked that we should be doing physical descriptions of ourselves. So let's take a moment to do that, and Mackenzie can start.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm just curious if people can tell, like, yeah, when they first see you.
Technology.
Oh no, Mackenzie, I can't hear you.
That's a great question. Yes, so I am in a wheelchair right now. I have a little pink wheelchair. I'm like my license says I'm like 4'8". I lied. I'm like 4'6" tall, so I'm pretty short. I'm in a pink wheelchair. And I go back and forth between walking and using my chair, but did a lot today, pretty long distance. So I'm in my chair mostly today.
Okay, question. How did you get a pink wheelchair? That's pretty cool.
Let me tell you, it's been pink since I was like 5-6 years old. They always tried to force me to get another color. They tried to give me red one time, but I looked at them and said, I'm a pink girl. It's just part of my personality, and it like gives me a lot of confidence. So it's been pink for a long time. It's quite the power color for me.
That's awesome. Okay, cool.
I can also describe myself on the heels of Mackenzie. My license says I'm 5 feet, but I round up to 5 feet as well.
So I'm quite short myself, and I have long brown hair, and I'm Caucasian, and I have brown eyes. Usually I wear glasses, but I'm not wearing glasses right now because I'm looking far away at a screen.
And I'm Lauren. I can describe myself. My license says I'm 5'4". We don't know if that's accurate or not. I have asked our friends in health services to measure me sometimes, just because I want to know. I am also a white woman. I have straight brown hair that's right around my shoulders. And today I'm wearing an off-white sweater with different color stripes on it, multicolor stripes. And I'm wearing blue glasses today.
And you already heard the video where I described myself as a very handsome man, so I feel like we got
that. But this is this is highly interpretable.
Yeah, I know. I figured that summarized it perfectly for everybody. right now, I wanted to show off this shirt. I made this shirt. It says "Normal Guy Who Follows All the Rules."
Let me guess.
It has a big picture of a skull on it looking really like fearsome, but it's in a really goofy, like cartoonish font. So the Normal Guy Who Follows All the Rules shirt is the shirt you wear to make people laugh at how you're trying to be fierce but failing. And it's a shirt many people buy.
Awesome. Okay, so I can describe myself, I think. So I am wearing, I believe, a black hijab. I am Middle Eastern look, I think. I'm not really sure what that really means. but my parents are Lebanese, so I think I look Lebanese. And you wouldn't tell on video that I'm blind, I don't think. But walking around, you would tell because I have my nice handy cane. So, and I think I'm wearing a purple shirt or pink. I'm not really sure. So I kind of want to connect with you, Melissa, on that, but yeah.
Zoom, it is purple or pink or pink or purple, magenta-ish. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to ask our last kind of big question, and then we'll see if folks around the room or online want to chat in some questions. So a big sort of push for our office lately has something that Lauren has already alluded to, which is a stance that students in higher education, especially students with disabilities, are anti-fragile as opposed to fragile. And anti-fragile meaning, you know, being able to grow stronger from adversity or pressure or difficult things that happen. There was a long period of time, and it's still kind of around, where colleges talk a lot about resilience and grit, and kind of the way I feel like it's a little different between that and anti-fragility is resilience is like you don't grow, you're like rubber and it just bounces off of you, so you can keep taking it, but you like don't grow. So we've started to think about anti-fragile as sort of growing and sort of being able to get stronger from this. And so, you know, there is this mindset, you know, Lauren alluded to it, and we have millions of examples, but a mindset in the community that people with disabilities are fragile and just can't do challenging things. So we are really working to change this narrative. We're working to change the narrative here with students and their families, with faculty and staff. And honestly, Lauren and I have started to take our show on the road here, and we have been trying to change that with disability service people that work at higher ed institutions across the nation, because, you know, we do think that there's still stigma even within those of us that provide this work. You know, I'm just curious about, you know, the whole point of this talk today was about how each one of you is living a bold life, and how, you know, I'm just wondering about any of your thoughts on how you maybe have embraced anti-fragility and how there might be some irony or some not in the word in of itself. If you have advice for students with disabilities who might be here or listening today that are also hoping to live a bold life.
I want to start and just say it's so ridiculous how little credit everybody gives themselves, regardless of your disability status, to be able to just do stuff and fail and then try something else. And I think the thing that has helped me most as an individual, autistic or not, is knowing that trying things and failing is healthy and necessary and fine. Mm-hmm. Learning your limits after you fail is really important. And that's something I had to learn after years of people getting mad at me for trying things the wrong way and failing. And it still happens. But realizing that, you know, if you're trapped in your room, afraid to take a risk and fail, your life will be bad. But if you go out and risk failing, your life can be great. And we can travel the world like all three of us have and do amazing things. And so I really encourage all my autistic siblings out there, it's okay to not know how to do something and try it and fail, but try to pay attention to what you did wrong and see how you can get better. And, you know, if I didn't live that way, I wouldn't have walked 70 miles from Albany to Saratoga Springs and back to go to the Korn concert. And that's the kind of thing that I'm proud of for life.
That was beautiful. Thank you. I love the way you said that. Well, I don't know if I love Korn as a band, but I do love the other parts you said.
So I kind of jump in here. I kind of think about this in two different ways. To be honest with you, with my disability, my parents kind of instilled this in me and always reinforced it when something would happen in my life, that everybody has something that they deal with and it all looks different from person to person. Mine happens to be brittle bones. You guys deal with something, it's going to look completely different from mine. So disability or not, we're all human beings. We're all doing the best we can. And that looks different for every single person. But also on the flip side of that, with my brittle bones, I have certainly experienced a life where many consider me to be fragile. And I used to have people come up to me all the time on the pool deck. And I kid you not, this happened when I was a child, a young swimmer. People came up to me on the deck and were like, why are you doing this? Or they would look at my parents and like, are you crazy for letting her swim in a lane or compete with others? Like, you're nuts. And that was just, it was really jarring at times as a child. But I think one thing I really thought about was never letting someone else define what I was capable of. And always knowing that no matter what came my way, no matter what fracture, I think that I really found that I could become a stronger version of myself on the other side of it. And I think that really helps. So I think remembering that we're all human, disability or not, doing the best that we can, but also remembering the inner strength of kind of beating back against that fragility that everybody sees in us.
Thank you. I love that. And I sort of love the, you know, the fact that you're literally fragile and you're like, screw fragile. No thanks. So I love that. No, you're up. Can you still hear us? Oop, you went mute. Now go on.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
I didn't realize. Okay. Anyways. So this is a really interesting concept. I'm going to like just share kind of my personal journey around it. I think when I was young, I learned very unfortunately, like at a very young age, that if I quote unquote acted blind, meaning I ran into something because clearly I can't see it, everybody reacted in a certain way, right? Reacted, wanted to stop me from doing something, wanted to quote unquote protect, you know, like I'm fragile, like I, you know, I can't do it. So as a kid, unfortunately, that became a very strong subliminal message where it resulted in me becoming really good at navigating spaces just so I wouldn't appear blind, which is crazy if you think about it, because like at the end of the day, like I can't really fake blindness, but in a lot of ways I masked, and that was just because of people reacting and, you know, wanting to protect me. And that meant my freedom was taken away. And if there's anything in the world that I don't want, God is my freedom, right? I want the independence to make my choices, to decide where to go, to, you know, ride a bike, even if I can't exactly see what's in front of me. And I think for a long time I internalized that. And then one day I realized that, and it wasn't just one day, it was actually over a course of, you know, a lot of therapy and like discussion, but I realized, no, like, I can be myself and still maintain my freedom, because I'm not actually fragile. So, yeah.
Joanne, do you have any, these are all wonderful, and I really hope students that are listening or watching are feeling this and are thinking to themselves some of this. Do any of you have any just advice for a student who might be sort of in that struggle place that you all may have been at a different point in your life? Or sometimes, you know, we're all human, we're going to have days where we still struggle to step back up again and get back out there.
Don't let anybody take your freedom. You have a choice. And it's hard. It's totally hard. But recognize that you deserve the right to choose.
Love that.
One thing we didn't get to, which is a question you had on the list, was about times where our basically where we fear disclosing. And something I was thinking about this is that every time I've disclosed my autism has been helpful to me. It went better. This isn't always going to be true. If you're talking to someone who has no idea what that means, it's maybe not going to work out. But being able to be openly yourself isn't just good for you. It's also helpful for other people around you, so they can understand you better. And so for, again, all the autistic people who are listening to this and you're afraid to disclose, you can be open about it. You don't need to be proud of or ashamed of it. Just be open, like, this is who I am, you know, no different than the fact that I have a nose. It's just a thing about me, and it's valid to know.
Thank you. And thanks for calling me out on skipping the question so we could let the audience ask him some questions. I appreciate it. Okay, Mackenzie, your turn.
I really like how Noah and Mona just put that. I think one of the things that really helped me that I probably tell others is to embrace who you are, because once I stop trying to fight it, and I'm not saying that every day is sunshine and rainbows, but I found a lot of strength in just embracing it. Not trying to fight against it, not trying to walk further than I needed to because I didn't want to have to use my wheelchair and be the different one, because I could actually use my wheelchair and be comfortable and enjoy what I was doing, or, you know, being afraid to partake in activities because it was going to look different for me. I would just stop living life. Like, live your life and embrace who you are. It's not always going to be easy, but it's definitely the option that will make you stronger and you'll be happier because of it.
Thank you. Now we're going to open it up to whether anybody in the room or anyone wants to toss a question into the chat, I guess, or unmute. It's always a fun game of like, who's going to do something? But if anyone has any questions.
And whoever goes first wins.
We have a candidate.
Hi, everyone. My name is Femina. I'm a staff member here at UMass Lowell. And where do I look? Is there a camera? No. Okay. I'm a staff member here at UMass Lowell. I help. I'm an academic advisor. I assist first year freshmen in our College of Fine Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences. My question is specifically for Mona. So as us, those that can see that Mona, as you also described, you wear a hijab. I grew up culturally Muslim. I don't wear a hijab, but both my parents are from Bangladesh, a majority Muslim country. And then Mona, you mentioned that you're Lebanese, another majority Muslim country. So my question for you is, has being either Lebanese or Muslim, or as you mentioned, Middle Eastern, on top of being blind, been like, how has it been able to navigate the world with all those identities? Thank you.
Okay, am I unmuted now?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Okay, that's a great question. And honestly, I've had that question before, and I feel like it's so deep and so complex. Okay. There's so many elements to it. Okay. First of all, just when people first see me, they first see that I'm blind. Okay. Well, depending on the circumstance. So then there's reactions towards that, right? But depending on the person who's seeing me, right? It really depends on who I'm interacting with. Different elements of my identity will show up and crop up or become a point of discussion or reaction, if that makes any sense. The majority of people who just come across my path, like, end up reacting to the blindness element. But then sometimes, yes, there is an element to the fact that I'm Muslim, the fact that I'm a woman, and if it ends up coming up, the fact that I'm a scientist, which, like, you know, is usually only at science conferences. So can I ask you more particularly, anything in particular you had in mind, like, about your question? It's so complex. Like, is there anything in particular? Like,
yeah. It is very complex, right?
And I'm a kid of immigrants, so let's not forget that either. Like, That's another identity. It's like, wow, okay, like, my parents didn't know about, you know, NSFGRFPs or SATs beforehand. You know, I was the first kid in my family, or exactly. Like, you know, like all of that. It's just like, there's so much, it's so interesting. Yeah.
I don't know if I like had anything more specific. My question was more like, as someone, as you're mentioning being blind, that's already a big complex, like, world to navigate, and then on top of that, being Muslim, Lebanese, immigrant or daughter of immigrant, like, a child of immigrants, like, that's a big complex set of identities, as we are all very complex, right?
A Bostonian.
On top of that, yes. Right? Maybe if you want to, like, narrow it a little bit down to, like, dealing with all those identities, like, currently, like, if you, like, in the
current, I'll tell you in a nutshell. I'm like, yeah, I'm an American. My views, my perspective, my rights belong as much, if not more, than anybody else. That's what I'm thinking. So, like, I feel like, you know, it's just recently, it's really, like, really brought up this feeling that we need to fight for, like, why do other perspectives have more of a right to exist than mine? I disagree with that. So it's really created that sense in me. I don't know if that's clear, but yeah.
You got a lot of head nods, so I'm going to say yes.
Okay, great. Can't see the head nods.
Like, so, that's why I thought I was clear.
Yeah. I feel like we need to catch up, and, like, I can talk about your question for, like, hours. So
I love that.
reach out. Okay.
Be in touch.
Hello. My name is Bryce. I'm a undergraduate student here at UML, and I am neurodivergent myself. I wanted to know, all three of you, depending on, you know, whoever would like to answer, how do you guys find the balance in your responses when dealing with infantilization while still asserting your right for higher support needs in areas?
Can you elaborate a little bit more?
I suppose the receive in navigating the world while I see avoiding or skirting infantilization in how one is treated while still trying to communicate that I there see. Might be different or higher support needs depending on how you live your life.
Yeah, great question. So basically, how can I ask for help without making people think less of me? It's a really good question. And I'll let you two answer it first. I don't have anything.
I can start. For me personally, I think you have to recognize that you aren't. Like, you have to deeply believe in yourself that you are not less than. That asking for help doesn't diminish what you are capable of doing. And so, when you ask for that help with confidence and just, it's a matter of fact, like, yeah, I need to hold on to your arm to be able to get from point A to point B because I can't see where I'm going. Like, just, it's a matter of fact, I need whatever extra time. And I can't speak for, like, your situation, but it starts with first, because for a long time, I did believe that I was somehow less than or broken for needing that extra help. But then I recognized, no, these are two separate issues, and I just need those things. They're tools. You're asking for tools to conduct what you need to conduct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like Mona just hit the nail on the head. Honestly, for me, growing up, there would be times where I'd have fractures and life would look a little bit different for a minute. And more often than not, when I was younger, I would fight having to ask for help as long as I possibly could. And in the process, sometimes I would hurt myself more. And I remember one day my mom was like, it's not because you're lesser than, it's not because you're incapable, it's because you're human. And at this moment, you need help. So for me, I almost feel like I had to push my ego aside a little bit. I had to push my pride aside a little bit. And I think that there's a strength in that. Like she was saying, I'm asking for help because I'm strong enough to know that I need it in this moment. And yes, I am very capable of doing many, many things on my own, but there's a lot of strength in admitting when there's a moment I might need to hold on to someone walking up a flight of stairs. I might need someone to take my backpack onto the plane and put it in the overhead bin because I can't reach it and it's dangerous for me. So I think it takes a lot of inner strength, and I think it takes a lot of practice too and experience.
It's the only thing I have to add. Those are great answers, but I want to mention it's okay for someone to look down on you for a not valid reason, because it's going to happen sometimes. And if you compensate by being impressive in other ways, your life will be fine. But I went to see Korn because I like that stuff. I'm not ashamed of it. It's unpopular. And despite this, I have other traits, and it doesn't bother me if people are like, I think that's stupid and you sound stupid for doing it. So that's the other piece of it, aside from asking for help.
Okay, to be fair, I just don't like the style of music. So
understandably, and that wasn't a diss at you, but it's a very common thing. Like, people are like, yes, this is a bad sign. I'm like, I don't care what you think about it.
You might feel similarly. Lauren shares a wall with me in this office, and the amount of Broadway I listen to might have a very similar reaction to a lot of other people's.
Can I share one thing to the student? I forgot. I think it was Bryce. For me also, sometimes just people, like in an airplane, this happens a lot. People make a preconceived assumption, right? So they want to put me in a wheelchair. And after a very long flight, actually physically for me, it's really important for me to walk. I just feel better. Usually my legs are all kind of puffed up from flying, you know? And I need to walk. I need to walk. And people will insist because you're blind. And I'm like, No. You're here to help me. You're going to help me the way I need, not the way you need. So that's another thing. Like Noah was saying, it doesn't necessarily matter what they think of you. You have a goal and a mission, and whatever tools you need, you pursue that. Sorry, I don't know if that made any sense.
Thank you. We're running a little close to the clock here. If somebody has one more squeeze in burning question, we're happy to take it, and then we'll do some wrap-up thoughts. Okay. I think Mackenzie does have a surprise for those in the room, though, if they want to stay for a second. You want to share what your surprise is?
Yes. So today I brought with me two of my Paralympic medals. I've got a medal from Rio, my gold, and I think this is the 100 free. And then I also brought my silver from the Paris Games last year in the 400 free. And then I think they might be able to hear this if I hold it up and show. Okay. So if you guys can hear this. This is the Rio gold medal. I just shook it. In Rio, they actually put beads inside each of the medals. Each color, gold, silver, and bronze, has a different number. And they make a really distinctive sound, which is very, very cool. It's something special that they did. But I love bringing these out.
Oh, so is it like audio accessible? Is it like accessible to the blind?
Yes, it is. Okay, so when we were at games, we actually had some of our visually impaired teammates come up, and as people were winning medals and bringing them to the stands, we would have them see if they could tell the difference between them, and they could, like, the sound is so distinctive. It's so cool. You could totally tell.
Wow, cool. My sister was actually at the games. Anyways.
Awesome. Oh my, wait, what sport? Wait,
she wasn't in a game. She was speaking because she was a special advisor to Biden at the time in international disability rights. She's blind herself as well.
Awesome. I love it. Oh my gosh.
Cool. So cool.
Can we have a microphone for you? Can we just have a microphone?
We're just reaching for a microphone for some closing thoughts here. Yeah,
Okay, so we always close our podcast with the same questions where we just ask each of us that have been participating maybe what's a takeaway that we would take with us to maybe think about more or something that affected us. So I'll go first. I think the biggest takeaway or kind of aha moment that I had was just a really a reminder that Noah gave me that, like, it's okay if something doesn't go well or you fail. You know, I think especially as people who work in education, I think we're always looking for perfection. We're trying to make everything as great as we can all the time. And I know for me, sometimes that means that I limit myself in terms of what my ideas are or what I might try to do. And that really doesn't benefit anybody. So it was just a great reminder of, like, you know, as we're going through the school year, it's okay to put up ideas or try something. And if it doesn't work, that's okay. But it just means it's a learning opportunity, and that part of life is failure sometimes. But if we don't try, then we'll never really make any advances. So that's my takeaway.
I think honestly, hearing Mona and Noah and their different opinions and takes on the questions is always eye-opening to me, because I think I forget sometimes that as a person with a disability, there's others with different disabilities out there, and it's not only my perspective that matters. Like, it always opens my eyes to something else. So I work with a lot of adaptive athletes, and it's always nice to hear a person with a different disability, their perspective on things. So I think I'll take a lot of that with me today and try to keep in mind that, especially this week, it's always the week after I go and do something like this. It's really awesome. And it really helps me kind of, relate to them better on their level and what they might be dealing with and going through. And it provides me the opportunity to further help them and their swimming and in their lives. So thank you for that, you guys. I really appreciate it.
You same. Seriously, both of you have such great things to say that I really appreciate being reminded of. And I think the other thing that this really made me think about is, despite everything, I still come off so autistic in this stuff in ways that are going to maybe upset people. And I hope not. I don't want that to be the case. So if you're mad, I hope you cut me some slack, or, you know, get in touch. I'm happy to talk about it, but I haven't done one of these big public panels in a while. And I forget how cautious I used to be, but as an old man, I have relaxed a little, and hopefully everyone's cool. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Honestly, like, it has been such an awesome conversation, and I really did also enjoy, like, hearing Noah's perspective on this. Like, I just really enjoyed, like, you guys are both done really big things in your lives, and that's awesome. But you know what struck me? It struck me that, Noah, you talked about how you made the film with your, like, you know, your buddies, right, in the comedy crew?
Yeah.
And, like, it still ended up being a product.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give you the final say.
Right.
That struck me. Like we still have some work to do. Like, that really struck me, you know, because I think I would have wanted to watch.
Yeah.
The film you intended.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Us too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody. And Noah, I think you did great. Good job shaking off that rust. I thought that was really good. And we were supposed to do this back in April, so let's be fair, right? So kind of like Mackenzie said, I feel like I have to spend some time, like, chewing on all the stuff that we talked about and the stuff that we processed. But I think, you know, I'm just appreciative that each one of you showed up, and, you know, we're brave enough to show up and have this conversation. And I really hope that, you know, some of the amazing things that each of you had to say about the life that you're choosing to live and how you want people to treat you will continue forward in people's minds, and our students with disabilities will hopefully leave this conversation with new expectations of how they expect people to treat them. So thank you so much. Thanks, everybody. Brandon, will you take a picture of this, like, sort of scenario here? And let's give a round of applause for our group. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, Noah, you want to get your t-shirt in that?
we're saying.
Yeah. Thank you. We're saying. I wasn't. Thank you so much. Thanks to the two of you up there on the screen and everybody else who joined us virtually, and then the about 20 people that were in the room with us as well. We're so appreciative. We'll be able to send the recording around, both the video and the audio, and a little bit. We like to fix up the captions. My diction isn't amazing usually, so we'll work with that.
Thank you so much. Thank you for, you know, having me. And yeah, I wish I could have been in person.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. Thanks.
Ready? Yeah, thank you for having me. Great. Right.